Welcome back to the program. As we spent some time talking about a man who was a master interpreter of songs, an Academy Award winner, a pioneer in the world of radio, screen, and television, Frank Sinatra was a star unlike any other, and he would forever change the face of our popular culture. We're going to talk about him today with my guest, James Kaplan. He's written essays and reviews, as well as over 100 major profiles for many major magazines and newspapers. It is my pleasure to have James Kaplan here to talk about his newest book, Frank the Voice. James Kaplan, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, I'm delighted to be here.
Great to have you here. When we look at Sinatra and the totality of his contribution, talk first about what he represented within the broader context of our popular culture. What nerve did he touch? What was it that made him so unique?
I think that he, I think when you're looking at Sinatra, you're looking at a career like no other. You're looking at a 60-year career. And Jeff, it's impossible, try as you might, to imagine any celebrity or entertainer, no matter how big these days, having a 60-year career. I defy you to. So when you're looking at Sinatra, you're really looking at America in the 20th century. His life touched so many areas in America, not just entertainment, but politics. The tabloids really, in a lot of ways, helped, for better and worse, carry his career along. It was a voice, it's a voice that is unmistakable and almost spooky in its quality to directly contact the listener. And we can talk all we want about breath control and phrasing and the way he studied the lyrics. All those things are very true. But my 11-year-old a couple of years ago, I was picking him up at school. He got into the car, and I happened to have Sinatra on the radio, which I don't all the time, believe it or not. And I said, I was joking around, because he's a regular 11-year-old. I said, you know who that is on the radio? He said, duh, Dad, that's Frank Sinatra. He's unmistakable. I just think you couldn't say that about any other singer over time, the way Sinatra has held up.
There's also this connection with Sinatra between the voice and all of the things that you're talking about and the personality. They come together in a rather unique way with Sinatra.
They do. His vulnerability, and it's hard to think of somebody who became so massively rich and famous as possessing vulnerability, but his vulnerability was intense and stayed with him his whole life. He was scarred at birth. He was 13 pounds when he was born. He was dragged out of his mother with forceps. They badly scarred the forceps, his ear, his left ear, the side of his face. When he was a kid, he had a mastoid operation, which further scarred the ear. When he was an adolescent, he had cystic acne, which pitted his face. He was a little guy. He was 5'7½", 127 pounds, soaking wet when he was a young man. He was also an Italian-American, and it's hard for us to think about in these days of diversity, or maybe not so hard for many residents of the United States to think about, but back in the 20s and 30s, Italian-Americans were not even officially considered white. And so Sinatra grew up not being terribly pleased with himself on a lot of fronts, and I really do think that he carried that insecurity his whole life, and it filtered into his music. He had a pocket, a core of sadness that made its way into his songs and directly contacted everybody who listened to them.
And in many ways, it reflected the temper of the times, particularly in post-war America, that combination, as you talk about, of vulnerability on the one hand and swagger on the other.
Well, just to cut it down a little more finely, it was during World War II that the ballads he sang propelled him to superstardom. The boys were overseas, the relatives at home, the women were thinking about them. There was an enormous amount of sadness and yearning in the country, and the young Sinatra really captured it. And that was what propelled him to greatness at first. In the years immediately after World War II, for 5 to 7 years after World War II, his career almost sank out of sight. There were a number of factors that came together, many of them self-inflicted, that would have sunk any 12 other stars. You know, he had tax trouble. He was cited at a major mafia conference in Havana, Cuba. by a columnist who started writing about it. These were the days when columnists had enormous power, and he was taken to, Sinatra was taken to task for being a mafia hanger-on. And then he left his wife and kids in 1949 for Ava Gardner, this gorgeous movie goddess. And you didn't do that in those days. And between the changes in popular music and all the infamy he brought on himself, his career by 1952, his record label dropped him. His agents dropped him. His movie studio dropped him. It was only when he was able to get that role in From Here to Eternity and then sign with Capitol Records for about $100, a new artist agreement, and begin making that incomparable string of great records with Nelson Riddle. That was what brought him back.
Was it the talent alone, or was it also Sinatra's sense of stagecraft that he brought to his own personal life?
You know, there were a lot of talented singers, and I'll mention a name that nobody's ever heard of and nobody will again. There was a guy named Buddy Clark, who was a very, very popular singer for Columbia Records in the 1940s, was killed in a plane crash. Well, if Buddy Clark had lasted into the age of television, his career would have died because he was a pudgy little guy with no particular stage presence. He just happened to have a wonderful voice. Sinatra and his voice were of a piece. The personality was electric. The eyes were electric blue. The insecurity and the sadness were omnipresent. And it was his insecurity and his impatience and his sadness that gave his personality a kind of electricity that communicated itself, whether he was in a record studio or in a radio studio or in a movie or on stage on TV. The personality always came through and always differentiated him from every other singer.
To what degree was there a sense of self-awareness of exactly what you're talking about on the part of Sinatra?
He knew he was a genius. He knew he was a genius from the age of 9. He said later on in life that when he was 9 years old, he heard the music of the spheres. And you didn't walk around Hoboken, New Jersey in the 1920s and 30s telling your pals that you heard the music of the spheres. You had to cultivate a tough exterior, which he did. But he was a master at promoting himself, at projecting himself. He knew exactly what he was about. He certainly had a lot of insecurity about the way he looked. On the other hand, he knew exactly how beautifully he could sing when he was in voice. He was aware of the power of his personality. He was aware that even though he was 5'7" and 130 pounds, he could make big men jump just by growling at them. He was completely aware of himself.
Mm-hmm. Talk about how his voice and his talents grew as he evolved, as he matured.
Well, you know, I think that with all human beings, our voices tend to deepen with age. If we don't take care of our voices, other bad things can happen to them. And Sinatra was not immune from that. You know, he was a chain smoker his whole life. He was a big drinker. Those things did affect his singing, and I think as he grew older, his voice naturally did deepen. When he began singing with Capitol Records, he was almost middle-aged. He was close to 40 years old in 1953 when he began with Nelson Riddle. And the voice that had been a higher and less strong voice, a more boyish voice for Columbia Records and during World War II, more boyish and yearning, suddenly turned into this oaken, cello-like baritone that was the mark of a mature man and really differentiated him in the 50s into the 60s. Later in life, of course, the voice got even deeper, and then as he got quite old, he began losing the voice a little bit.
Talk a little bit about that kind of conflict that you write about, that explosive conflict that existed within his voice.
I think that there was, you may remember, there was a singer who died recently, a singer named Frankie Lane, who was very popular in the 50s and 60s, you know, with his great recording of Mule Train. And they used to say of Frankie Lane that he had lungs of leather. You know, he could sing, he could sing all day and all night. The producer Mitch Miller once said about the singer Gordon McRae that he could sing underwater. It didn't matter what he did to his voice. Sinatra was different. He was affected by smoke, by drink. You know, there's a famous story of Sinatra sitting around a TV set in the 60s after a bad night and trying to get his voice together to sing on TV and muttering to himself, drink, 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 smoke, 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 schmuck, schmuck, schmuck. He very strongly felt that about himself. Mitch Miller also said that Sinatra's voice was affected by what Mitch Miller called guilt germs. Sinatra was, he was a man who all his life loved women, sought women out, was constantly with women. He talked about how it was an exaggeration how many women he had been with. I don't think it was. I think he was probably with more than that. But he had left his wife and his children in the late 40s. It was a terrible thing. It injured him as well as them. It hurt them more than it hurt him, but it hurt him deeply, and it did affect his voice.
How was he able to convey his own personality, his own personal angst, and all of these issues that we've been talking about through that voice? Because one of the things that has been said so much about Sinatra over the years is that listening to him was a much more personal experience than listening to others at the time.
There, I can tell you some concrete things, Jeff, and I can tell you one unconcrete thing. The concrete things are that he knew from the jump that he wanted to be different from other singers, and a lot of that had to do with breath control. He heard other singers, no matter how good their voices were, take a breath, pause to take a breath in the middle of a phrase. They'd be saying all the things you are, and between the things and you are, they would take a breath. And to Sinatra, that sounded totally phony. So he studied under the great Tommy Dorsey, with whose band he sang in the early 1940s. Dorsey had incredible breath control. Sinatra worked on his, so he could sing a phrase straight through without pausing. He also studied the lyrics of his songs very deeply. He read the lyrics almost like a poem before he ever sang a note. And because he studied those lyrics so well, he really inhabited the song in a way that other singers didn't and couldn't. And he really did make you feel he was singing directly to you and you alone. And then I would go back to what my kid said about how his voice is unmistakable. There's something almost spooky and undefinable about what sets his voice apart. You know, you can Michael Feinstein, the wonderful singer and pianist, said to me, you can measure voices on a meter, you can see the needle move, and you can chart them on a piece of paper. But in the end, there's something about a great voice like Sinatra's that is just unknowable. There's a magic to it that's instantly recognizable.
Who were the people that really had, you mentioned Tommy Dorsey before, others that really had a powerful influence on Sinatra?
Bing Crosby was the first and major influence on Sinatra. You know, Bing Crosby, whom we should never forget and whom I adore and idolize, came along in the 1930s at a time when it's easy to forget that male singers back then, they all sounded sort of, most of them sort of had high-pitched voices. This came from the days when, before microphones, you had to have a high-pitched voice to reach the back rows. They sang in a very affected way, most male crooners then, slightly English accent, maybe a little effeminate sounding. Bing Crosby came along. Bing Crosby sounded like a man. He sounded like a guy. He sounded like he was really telling you a story. And when men listened to Bing Crosby, they all felt they could sing as well as Bing. Well, you know, Sinatra felt the same thing. And 99% of those men were wrong about being able to sing like Bing, but Sinatra could.
And talk a little bit about who Sinatra idolized. Who did he look up to?
He idolized Bing Crosby. He was flabbergasted the first time he actually met him as a young man on a movie set in Hollywood. He idolized Tommy Dorsey. Tommy Dorsey to Sinatra represented class. He represented power. Tommy Dorsey was not only a great trombonist, a great band leader, he was a great businessman. He ran his band when Sinatra sang with him like a well-oiled machine and really made money, as a lot of band leaders had trouble with, Dorsey did not have trouble with that. Sinatra idolized Billie Holiday. Billie Holiday was born just a few months before Sinatra, and yet her career matured much quicker than Sinatra's. She was a great singer when he heard her on 52nd Street in Manhattan in the 1930s, and had a way of conveying a song like nobody else.
Who did he trust in his career?
Very few people. He trusted the man who signed him to Columbia Records, Manny Sachs, in the early 40s, and then they fell out. He trusted his longtime pianist, Bill Miller, to support him and accompany him in an incomparable way. Of course, Bill Miller was the guy who played that amazing piano solo when it was just he and Sinatra in One for My Baby, One for the Road. He trusted a longtime friend of his, beginning in the late 1950s until almost the end of his life, a man named Jilly Rizzo. But you know, Sinatra was so famous, so rich, so powerful that he had a lot of sycophants, a lot of toadies, a lot of hanger-ons kissing his rear end and saying nice things to him. It was hard for him to trust people. He trusted his children. He trusted Jilly Rizzo. He trusted Manny Sachs. Very few other people.
Because there really is the sense of a guy that, although he was surrounded by people all the time, a guy that was very much alone.
I say in the book that he was the loneliest SOB that he had ever met. Sinatra was an incredibly lonely man.
To what extent did that impact his work, both as an actor and as a singer?
I think that you hear the loneliness in the voice. You mm-hmm. hear the tragedy of Sinatra. He was because he was scarred from birth, because he felt himself one down as an Italian American, as a little guy. He always had that chip on his shoulder that helped contribute to his feelings of solitude and sadness. As a movie actor, I think he brought to his first great dramatic role, Angelo Maggio in From Here to Eternity, when he read James Jones's great novel that was going to be adapted to the screen. Sinatra felt that this guy, this little guy from Brooklyn who ends up getting killed in the book, this tough-talking little guy, was him. And I think he brought to that role and to all his great roles in the movies, and there were several of them, this sense of the little guy, this sense of the solitary man.
What's so remarkable is for a guy that had so much success in the musical world, that it really took this acting role in From Here to Eternity to resurrect his career in the early 50s.
Yes, that moment when he went up on the stage to get the Oscar, March 25th, 1954, what marked the greatest showbiz comeback of all time. There has never been anybody whose career was as dead as that, who came back as far as that. And everybody in that audience that night, at the Pantages Theater in Hollywood when he won the Oscar, nobody liked him that much in Hollywood. He was a guy who was an outsider in Hollywood as well. He was renowned for only giving a director one take. That was all he gave. But everybody in that audience, they may not have liked him, but they were all rooting for him, and they went wild when he got that Oscar.
Why didn't they like him?
He didn't give. Hollywood loves its insiders. It loves people who work hard within the system, who play by the rules. Sinatra never played by the rules. You know, when he recorded a song, he would do as many takes as it took. There were songs he did that took as many as 22 takes. He would stay there all night, no matter how long it took to get the song right. With the movies, his etched in concrete rule was, I will give you one take. That's when I'm best. That's when I'm freshest. After that, I'm out of here. He was an incredibly impatient man. If you've ever been on a movie set, watching movies getting made is like watching paint dry. Sinatra hated the rhythms of it. He knew that he needed screen acting to push his singing career forward. And I think that part of him was respectful toward the movies. He certainly respected Gene Kelly, with whom he acted a number of times, but some of the directors he worked with. At the same time, he was always an outsider in Hollywood.
How did he figure that out, that he needed that screen success to resurrect his music career?
Again, that came from Crosby. Crosby was a huge star in the 30s and 40s, and a lot of that was built on his appearances on screen. It was great to sing on the radio, but Sinatra saw that when Bing got on the screen, big ears and all, and they used to tape back Crosby's ears so they wouldn't stick out so far. And they did the same thing with Sinatra, too. They taped back his ears, which also stuck out. Sinatra saw that Crosby's career really, really took off when he appeared in the movies.
Talk about the resurrection of his singing career through the Capitol deal.
Well, you know, in 1952, Columbia Records, which had a lot of hit records with Sinatra, but who had started losing money on Sinatra as late as the mid-40s, decided not to throw any more good money after bad, and they cut him off. They ended his contract, and Sinatra, who was in so much trouble from so many sources, again self-inflicted, and broke, and with the IRS after him, couldn't get a job. He couldn't get arrested. There was a great recording executive named Alan Livingston, a very far-sighted young man who was working for Capitol Records. He decided that he was going to sign Sinatra because Sinatra was a brilliant singer. Well, that's a little more revolutionary than it sounds. When Alan Livingston announced to his salesman at a big sales conference that he had signed Sinatra, every man in the room groaned. The linking of Sinatra with Nelson Riddle was really Alan Livingston's idea, and it was bringing together two geniuses who created this whole string of incredible genius albums.
Talk about that pairing.
Nelson Riddle was very similar to Sinatra in a lot of ways. He was from New Jersey. He was a lonely man. He was a sad man. He was a genius. He was a musical genius. And he had a way, you know, Sinatra's great arranger during the Columbia period, during World War II, was a man named Axel Stordahl, who was a great, great arranger, had a great way of arranging for strings that supported Sinatra's ballad singing during World War II. But when Sinatra's voice changed and popular music changed, something different had to be done, and Nelson Riddle was the guy to do it. He could not only arrange strings beautifully, he could arrange horns beautifully. He had classical training. He had a genius ear. He had a way of creating a sound that perfectly backed Sinatra and didn't sound like anything else that had ever been done. When you listen to, just listen to the first 30 seconds, 20 seconds of Young at Heart, recorded in 1953 when Sinatra first began with Capitol. And you'll hear, it gives me goosebumps every time, you'll hear something that had never been done before in popular music. Nelson Riddle made that happen.
And how did the public respond to it?
Instantly. Not quite instantly. It took a couple of months, but those records started taking off very fast because they are great records. And when Wee Small Hours came out, when Only the Lonely came out, the American public knew that these were magnificent, unique albums that they just had to buy, and they bought them.
And how was Sinatra's audience different at that point than it had been originally?
His original audience and the engine of his superstardom was a group that had never really quite existed in America before. And that's not to say that teenage girls had never existed in America before. You had them during the Revolutionary War. But after the Depression was over in World War II, you had a mass of teenage girls in America who suddenly had a little money in their pockets. They could afford to buy records. And when they started seeing Sinatra performing with Tommy Dorsey, there was this chemical, atomic reaction. The guy was young. He was vulnerable. He had the soft voice with a catch in it. He had the little curl over his forehead. He had the electric blue eyes, magnificent voice, songs of yearning, and these girls went nuts. Now, those girls matured after World War II, and when American popular music tastes changed after World War II, Sinatra lost his popularity. But his audience came back to him in the early and mid-50s, more men this time, more men, because they were hearing this voice of vulnerability, but of deep trustworthiness, of deep emotion that they really reacted to. So the audience got a little more mature. The old joke about Sinatra, just imagine how many million babies were conceived to the sound of his singing. It's true. It was an intensely romantic sound in the early and mid 50s, and it was a sound again like nobody else's.
And how did he respond to that newer audience? Did he trust it? Did he trust himself?
Yes, he trusted himself absolutely. His singing, his stage presence, to use the rocket metaphor again, just shot upwards, just took off in the early to mid-50s. The story is, and the story is true, that when he sang one of those first arrangements by Nelson Riddle, I've Got the World on a String, after he nailed that take, and just listen to it, it's a magnificent take of I've Got the World on a String, he said, I'm back, baby, I'm back. And he knew it. He knew it, and he knew it throughout the 50s.
James Kaplan, the book just out from Doubleday is Frank, the Voice. James, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, Jeff, it's a great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.
Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh when your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth to be young at heart?